A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was talking with someone over the weekend about a drug called Ibogaine, and it got him curious. He knows we've touched on hallucinogens in pharmacotherapy before, but what he really wants to dig into is the claim that Ibogaine can reset addictions. Not just classical substance addictions, but maybe addictive behaviors more broadly. He's asking what the science actually says, whether the mechanism of action has been figured out, and if there's any serious research looking at bringing it into the legitimate pharmacopoeia.
By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro writing our script. This one sits at a really strange intersection. It's a schedulized substance in the US, same category as heroin, which means the DEA officially considers it to have no accepted medical use and high abuse potential. But the research story is almost the opposite of that classification.
Which is one of those moments where the scheduling system starts looking less like a scientific framework and more like a bureaucratic artifact.
What makes Ibogaine particularly interesting is that it's not just another psychedelic people are curious about. The claim is that a single dose can dramatically reduce or eliminate withdrawal symptoms from opioids, and in some cases, significantly reduce cravings for months afterward. If it's true, it would be unlike almost anything else in addiction medicine.
Let's start with what it actually is, because I think most people have heard of ayahuasca, but Ibogaine is the lesser-known sibling Daniel mentioned. Where does it come from?
It comes from the root bark of a shrub called Tavernanthia boga, native to Central West Africa, particularly Gabon. It's been used for centuries in the Bwiti spiritual tradition, initiation ceremonies, coming-of-age rituals. The psychoactive effects are intense and long-lasting. We're talking about a trip that can last 24 hours or more, and it's not described as pleasant. People report confronting traumatic memories, experiencing a kind of life review, and often going through a physically grueling period of ataxia and vomiting.
The soul-searching crowd Daniel mentioned is signing up for a day of vomiting and confronting their worst memories, which really makes you wonder about the appeal.
The appeal is almost entirely downstream of the outcome. People don't take Ibogaine for fun. They take it because they're desperate. The typical story is someone with a severe opioid addiction who's tried methadone, tried buprenorphine, tried abstinence, and nothing stuck. They travel to a clinic in Mexico or Costa Rica or the Netherlands, undergo this grueling experience, and a surprising number describe coming out the other side with withdrawal symptoms dramatically reduced and cravings muted.
How much of that is real versus anecdote and wishful thinking? Because addiction treatment is an area absolutely plagued by people seeing what they want to see.
That's the right question. The observational data is compelling. A paper in the Journal of Psychedelic Studies a few years back followed 50 people who underwent Ibogaine treatment for opioid dependence, and at 12 months, something like 55% reported sustained abstinence. That's remarkably high for a population that had failed multiple other treatments. But it was observational, not randomized, and the people who seek out Ibogaine are self-selected in ways that make interpretation difficult.
There's a safety question that looms over all of this, right? I've seen headlines about people dying during Ibogaine sessions.
The cardiac risk is real and serious. Ibogaine prolongs the QT interval. That's a measure of the heart's electrical cycle, and in susceptible individuals, that can trigger a dangerous arrhythmia called torsades de pointes. There have been at least 30 documented fatalities, mostly in unsupervised settings or in people with pre-existing cardiac issues or electrolyte imbalances. The mortality risk is estimated somewhere around 1 in 300 to 1 in 400 treatments, which is high enough that you can't hand-wave it away.
1 in 300 is not a rounding error. That would be unacceptable for almost any approved medication.
That's the central tension with Ibogaine. The potential benefit is enormous, breaking an addiction that might otherwise kill someone. But the treatment itself carries a non-trivial risk of sudden cardiac death. It's a brutal risk-benefit calculus.
Which makes the mechanism of action question Daniel asked about all the more important. If you can figure out how it works, maybe you can isolate the therapeutic part from the cardiotoxic part.
This is where the science has gotten genuinely interesting. There was a major paper in Nature in late 2024 that really advanced our understanding. The researchers, a team out of Stanford and UCSF, mapped ibogaine's binding sites and found something unexpected. Ibogaine is what they call a dirty drug, meaning it hits a lot of different receptors. It binds to serotonin transporters, to kappa and mu opioid receptors, to NMDA receptors, to nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. It's all over the map.
A pharmacological shotgun.
The conventional wisdom for a long time was that you'd want to clean that up. Find the one receptor responsible for the anti-addictive effect and target that selectively. But the 2024 Nature paper suggested something more interesting. The therapeutic effect might actually depend on ibogaine hitting multiple targets simultaneously. It's not one mechanism, it's a coordinated modulation across several systems.
Which would make it harder to tease apart the good from the bad. If the cardiotoxicity is coming from one of those same receptors that's also needed for the anti-addictive effect, you've got a real problem.
That's the thing. The cardiac effect seems to be primarily mediated through the HERG potassium channel. That's the channel responsible for QT prolongation. And that appears to be somewhat separable from the anti-addictive effects, which involve a different set of targets. So the question becomes whether you can design an analog, a chemical cousin, that retains the therapeutic binding profile while avoiding the HERG channel interaction.
Has anyone done that?
There's a company called Delix Therapeutics that's been working on exactly this, non-hallucinogenic ibogaine analogs. In late 2025, they published preclinical data showing that one of their lead compounds, something called DLX7, produced anti-addictive effects in animal models without the cardiac signal and without the hallucinogenic trip.
You'd lose the 24-hour vision quest and just get the pharmacological benefit. Which, for the people Daniel is asking about, people who don't find the idea of a weird wavy reality appealing, would actually be the preferred version.
That gets at something important about the whole psychedelic medicine movement. There's been this debate about whether the subjective experience, the trip, is necessary for the therapeutic effect. Some researchers argue the profound psychological experience is the mechanism. Others think it's just a side effect you can engineer out.
The ibogaine analog work suggests you can engineer it out and still get the anti-addictive benefit, at least in animals.
In animals, yeah. And that's a huge caveat. Addiction is a complex human phenomenon with social and psychological dimensions that don't map neatly onto a mouse pressing a lever for morphine. But the preclinical data is promising enough that it's attracted serious attention.
What about the research landscape more broadly? Daniel asked whether anyone is actually looking at incorporating ibogaine into the legitimate pharmacopoeia. Is this all happening in the shadows and in Mexican clinics, or is there real institutional movement?
There is real movement, and some of it is happening in surprising places. Texas has become an unexpected hub for this. In mid-2025, the Texas legislature allocated funding for ibogaine research through the University of Texas system, specifically targeting opioid addiction. Governor Abbott signed off on it. And then in early 2026, there was an executive order from the White House directing the NIH and the FDA to streamline the process for psychedelic drug research, with ibogaine specifically named alongside psilocybin and MDMA.
Wait, so we've got a Republican governor in Texas and a Trump administration, both pushing forward on psychedelic research? That's not the political alignment most people would expect.
No, and it cuts across the usual partisan lines in interesting ways. You've got veterans groups advocating for this because of the PTSD and addiction crisis among former military personnel. You've got the traditional drug war conservatives pushing back. And you've got the libertarian-leaning wing making the case that if something works, the government shouldn't stand in the way.
The opioid crisis has a way of reshaping political calculus. When you've got entire communities devastated by fentanyl, the old just say no framework starts looking inadequate, and people become willing to consider things they'd have dismissed a decade ago.
The numbers are staggering. We're still losing over 70,000 Americans a year to opioid overdoses. The existing treatments, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone, they help, but relapse rates are high. Somewhere between 40 and 60% of people on medication-assisted treatment relapse within a year. If Ibogaine or an Ibogaine analog could move that needle even modestly, it would be a public health intervention of enormous consequence.
Let's talk about the Texas initiative specifically. What's actually happening there?
The program is being run out of UT Health San Antonio, and they're starting with a phase 2 trial focusing on veterans with opioid use disorder. The trial design is interesting because they're not just looking at abstinence as the endpoint. They're measuring quality of life, employment outcomes, family reunification, the broader picture of what recovery actually looks like. And they're doing it in a controlled hospital setting with cardiac monitoring, electrolyte management, the full safety protocol.
Which addresses the cardiac risk directly. You can manage QT prolongation if you know it's happening and you've got the patient in a monitored setting.
The fatalities we've seen have mostly been in settings where nobody was checking potassium and magnesium levels, nobody had an ECG running, nobody had a defibrillator on hand. In a proper medical setting, the risk profile changes substantially. Not to zero, but to a level that might be acceptable given the alternative, which for many of these patients is a high probability of death from overdose.
The Texas trial is specifically using Ibogaine itself, not an analog.
As far as I understand, yes. They're using the natural compound. The analog work is happening in parallel through private companies. The advantage of using the natural compound is that we already have decades of observational data on it. The disadvantage is exactly what we've been discussing, the cardiac risk and the hallucinogenic effects.
What about the mechanism question in more detail? Daniel asked specifically whether it's been figured out. What's actually happening in the brain during and after an Ibogaine experience that might explain the addiction reset?
There are a few layers to this. The first is neurochemical. Ibogaine is metabolized in the liver into a compound called noribogaine, which has a very long half-life. It sticks around in the body for weeks after a single dose. Noribogaine is a potent agonist at the kappa opioid receptor, and kappa receptor activation seems to play a role in resetting the dopamine system that addiction hijacks.
The metabolite might actually be doing a lot of the therapeutic work?
That's the current thinking. The ibogaine itself produces the intense acute experience, but noribogaine is what lingers and may be responsible for the sustained anti-craving effect. And noribogaine is not particularly hallucinogenic on its own, which is another piece of evidence suggesting the trip and the therapeutic effect might be separable.
Which would explain why people report reduced cravings for weeks or months after a single dose. You got this long-acting metabolite sitting on the relevant receptors.
The second layer is neuroplastic. There's evidence that ibogaine and noribogaine promote the expression of something called GDNF, glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor, which is a protein that supports the survival and regrowth of neurons. Addiction is associated with structural changes in the brain's reward circuitry. The idea is that ibogaine might be promoting a kind of neural repair process, essentially helping the brain remodel itself back toward a pre-addiction state.
That's a much more profound claim than just blocking withdrawal symptoms. You're talking about literally rebuilding neural architecture.
That's why the research community is so interested despite the risks. If this mechanism is real, it's not just a symptomatic treatment. It might actually be addressing some of the underlying neurobiological damage that addiction causes. Most of our addiction treatments are essentially substitution therapies or relapse prevention tools. They don't claim to reverse the underlying pathology.
All right, so we've got a fascinating mechanism story. But let me push on something. Daniel mentioned addictive behaviors, not just classical substance addictions. Is there any evidence that ibogaine's effect generalizes beyond opioids and stimulants to behavioral addictions? Gambling, compulsive eating, that kind of thing?
The evidence there is much thinner. There are case reports, individual people who've reported that their compulsive behaviors diminished after ibogaine treatment. But no controlled studies that I'm aware of specifically targeting behavioral addictions. The neurobiological plausibility is there because the dopamine system is involved in behavioral addictions too, but the leap from plausibility to demonstrated efficacy is a big one.
You'd want to be especially careful about safety in populations where the addiction isn't directly life-threatening. The risk-benefit calculus for someone with a gambling addiction is different from someone who's overdosed 3 times.
With opioid addiction, you're weighing a roughly 1 in 300 risk of cardiac death from the treatment against something like a 1 in 20 annual risk of death from overdose for someone with severe opioid use disorder. That math favors the treatment. For behavioral addictions, the mortality risk is lower, so the same treatment risk becomes harder to justify.
Which is exactly why the analog approach matters so much. If you can get the cardiac risk down to near zero, the calculus changes for a much broader range of conditions.
That's where Delex and a few other companies are aiming. There's also a group at Johns Hopkins and a team at the University of California. The Ibogaine analog space has become surprisingly competitive in the last 18 months.
What about the international picture? Daniel mentioned ayahuasca and ibogaine as siblings, and ayahuasca has a whole ecosystem of retreat centers in South America. Is there a parallel ibogaine tourism industry?
There is, and it's centered primarily in Mexico and Costa Rica, with some clinics in the Netherlands. The quality and safety standards vary wildly. Some clinics are essentially run by former addicts who had transformative experiences and want to help others, well-intentioned but not necessarily medically rigorous. Others have proper medical staff and cardiac monitoring. The lack of standardization is a huge problem.
If you're an American traveling to one of these clinics, you're operating in a regulatory gray zone. You're not breaking U.S. law by consuming the substance abroad, but if something goes wrong, you're in a foreign medical system with a complicated situation.
There have been cases of Americans dying in these settings. There was a case in 2023 of a young man from Colorado who traveled to a clinic in Mexico, had an undiagnosed heart condition, and didn't survive the session. These stories are devastating, and they highlight exactly why the push for controlled clinical research is so important. If ibogaine works, and the evidence suggests it might, it needs to be delivered in a setting where the risks are managed properly.
The Texas trial is essentially trying to create that setting, the controlled, monitored, medically rigorous version, and generate the kind of data the FDA would need to even consider rescheduling.
The FDA has shown some flexibility here. They granted breakthrough therapy designation to psilocybin for depression a few years back and to MDMA for PTSD. The ibogaine researchers are hoping for similar treatment, especially with the 2026 executive order signaling that the administration wants to see movement on this.
What's the timeline look like realistically? If the Texas Phase 2 trial goes well, what's the path to something a doctor could actually prescribe?
Optimistically, 5 to 7 years. That's assuming the Phase 2 results are positive, that a Phase 3 trial gets funded and enrolls quickly, and that the FDA review process goes smoothly. And that's for ibogaine itself, in a controlled medical setting. The analogs might take longer because they have to go through the full development pipeline from Phase 1 onward.
We're not talking about something that's going to show up at your local pharmacy anytime soon. This is a medium-term prospect at best.
That's important to be clear about because there's a lot of hype in this space. People hear psychedelic breakthrough and imagine a world transformed next year. The reality is that drug development is slow, expensive, and most things that look promising in early stages don't pan out.
Which brings us back to Daniel's question about the science. What would you say is the state of the evidence right now?
The honest characterization is that the observational evidence is strong enough to justify serious investigation. The mechanistic understanding has advanced dramatically in the last 2 years. The safety concerns are real but potentially manageable, and we are still years away from knowing whether this actually works in a rigorous controlled setting. I'm cautiously optimistic but not triumphalist about it.
That's a fair summary, and it's worth noting that the ibogaine story is part of a broader shift in how we think about addiction. For decades, the dominant models were either moral failing or chronic disease managed through substitution. The idea that you might be able to intervene pharmacologically to reset the brain's reward system, that's a different paradigm.
It's not just ibogaine. There's interesting work on ketamine for addiction, on psilocybin for smoking cessation, on MDMA-assisted therapy for alcohol use disorder. The common thread seems to be that these compounds, used in the right context, can create a window of neuroplasticity, a period where the brain is more malleable and more receptive to change. The ibogaine story fits into that broader pattern.
The fact that noribogaine lingers for weeks might mean that ibogaine opens a particularly long window, which could be part of why it seems to work after a single dose in a way that most other treatments don't.
That's the hypothesis, and if it's confirmed, it would be a novel approach to addiction treatment. Most of our current pharmacotherapies require daily dosing and essentially manage the condition chronically. A treatment that could produce lasting change after a single intervention, that's a different category of medicine entirely.
All right, Let's talk about the cardiotoxicity in a bit more detail, because I think it's the central obstacle, and people should understand exactly what the concern is.
The QT interval is a measure of how long it takes for the heart's ventricles to repolarize after each beat. When the QT interval is prolonged, you're vulnerable to a specific type of arrhythmia where the heart essentially quivers instead of pumping effectively. That arrhythmia can degenerate into ventricular fibrillation and cardiac arrest. It's the same reason certain antibiotics and antipsychotics carry cardiac warnings.
Ibogaine is particularly potent at causing this?
It's one of the more potent QT prolonging compounds known. The HERG channel I mentioned earlier, that's the potassium channel that mediates cardiac repolarization. Ibogaine blocks it pretty effectively. And the effect is dose-dependent, which is part of why the fatalities tend to happen in unsupervised settings where dosing might be imprecise.
When the Texas trial is doing this in a hospital setting, what are they actually doing to manage that risk?
They're doing continuous ECG monitoring for the duration of the acute effects and for some period afterward. They're checking electrolyte levels before treatment and correcting any deficiencies. Low potassium or magnesium makes the QT prolongation more dangerous. They're screening out anyone with pre-existing cardiac conditions or a family history of sudden cardiac death, and they have resuscitation equipment on hand. It's the difference between skydiving with a properly packed parachute and a backup versus jumping off a cliff with a bedsheet.
That's a vivid image. And the analog approach would essentially be designing a parachute that doesn't have the manufacturing defect in the first place.
If you can modify the molecule so it doesn't bind to HERG, but retains binding to the therapeutic targets, you eliminate the cardiac risk at the source rather than managing around it.
Has anyone looked at whether the cardiac risk varies by population?
There's some evidence that slow metabolizers, people with certain genetic variants in the CYP2D6 enzyme that processes ibogaine, might be at higher risk because the drug stays in their system longer. And women tend to have longer baseline QT intervals than men, which might make them more susceptible. But the data is limited because most of what we know comes from case reports and small studies, not large systematic investigations.
Which is another argument for getting this into proper clinical trials. You can't answer these questions from anecdotes in underground clinics.
That's exactly the argument the researchers are making to the FDA. The current situation, where people are using ibogaine anyway in uncontrolled settings without proper screening, is the worst of all worlds. Bringing it into the clinical research framework would at least allow us to understand the risks properly and develop evidence-based protocols.
What about Daniel's point about not finding the subjective experience appealing? I think that's worth addressing, because there's a cultural narrative around psychedelics that sometimes romanticizes the trip in a way that can feel alienating to people who just want the therapeutic benefit.
I think Daniel's reaction is actually the more common one. Most people don't want to spend 24 hours vomiting and reliving their traumas. The people who seek that out are either in profound distress or have a particular psychological makeup. And the ibogaine analog work suggests that the trip might not be necessary, which, if confirmed, would make these treatments accessible to a much broader population.
There's an interesting question embedded here about whether the difficulty of the experience is itself part of the therapeutic mechanism. Some people describe ibogaine as a kind of ordeal. You go through something harrowing, and coming out the other side is psychologically transformative in a way that a gentle pharmacological intervention might not be.
That's a live debate in the field. There are researchers who argue that the subjective experience is integral, that you need the psychological confrontation for lasting change. And there are others who point to the animal data, where rats clearly aren't having existential insights, but still show reduced drug-seeking behavior after ibogaine analogs.
The rats aren't having a life review.
The rats are not contemplating their childhoods, no, and yet they still show an effect. Which suggests that at least some component of the anti-addictive effect is purely pharmacological and doesn't require a subjective experience at all.
That's reassuring for people like Daniel, who don't find the idea of a hallucinogenic ordeal appealing. And it also opens up the possibility of ibogaine-derived medications that could be prescribed like any other drug. Take this pill. It'll help with your cravings. No vision quest required.
That's the long-term vision that companies like Delix are pursuing. Whether it pans out is still uncertain, but the preclinical data is encouraging enough to justify the effort.
All right, let's step back and talk about the addiction piece more broadly. What do we actually know about how Ibogaine affects the psychology of compulsion?
The honest answer is not much, at least from a rigorous research perspective. The anecdotes are intriguing. Reports of people who went for opioid addiction and found that their compulsive gambling or eating disorder also improved. But anecdotes are not data, and there could be all sorts of confounding factors.
The neurobiology would suggest some common pathways, though, right? Dopamine dysregulation shows up in behavioral addictions, too.
And the GDNF mechanism I mentioned, the neurotrophic factor that promotes neural repair, that would theoretically apply to any addiction-related neural circuitry, regardless of whether the addiction is to a substance or a behavior. But that's theoretical. We don't have the studies to back it up yet.
If someone came to you and said, I've got a gambling problem and I'm considering going to an Ibogaine clinic in Mexico, what would you tell them?
I'd tell them that the evidence for Ibogaine's effectiveness in behavioral addictions is essentially non-existent, that the cardiac risk is real, and that there are evidence-based treatments for gambling disorder, cognitive behavioral therapy, naltrexone, that have a much better established safety profile and should be tried first. The risk-benefit math just doesn't favor Ibogaine for behavioral addictions right now.
That's a responsible answer. And it highlights something important. The enthusiasm can sometimes outrun the evidence. Opioid addiction is the strongest case, because the need is so desperate and the observational data is most robust there. Everything else is extrapolation.
Even for opioids, we need the randomized controlled trials before we can say with confidence that Ibogaine works. The observational data is suggestive, but not definitive. Selection bias is a powerful thing.
Speaking of selection bias, let's talk about the population that's been using Ibogaine up to now. Who are these people?
The typical Ibogaine patient is someone who's been through the addiction treatment system multiple times and failed. They've done detox, rehab, methadone, or Suboxone, and they're still using. They're often in their 30s or 40s, addicted for a decade or more, and they've reached a point of desperation. They hear about Ibogaine through word of mouth or online forums, and they scrape together the money. Treatment at a Mexican clinic can cost anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000, and they go.
It's a heavily self-selected population of treatment-resistant cases, which makes the reported success rates either more impressive, because these are the hardest cases, or more suspicious, because these are people who are highly motivated to believe it worked.
Both things can be true. And that's exactly why you need the controlled trials. You need to see what happens when you take people who have it self-selected, randomize them to Ibogaine versus placebo or standard treatment, and follow them over time.
The Texas trial is doing that with veterans. Any sense of when we might see results?
The trial is still recruiting, and phase 2 trials typically take 2 to 3 years from start to publication. So we're probably looking at 2027 or 2028 before we see peer-reviewed results. Which feels like a long time, but in drug development terms, that's actually moving pretty fast.
In the meantime, people are still going to clinics in Mexico, still taking the risk, still operating outside the medical system.
That's the frustrating reality. The demand is there, the desperation is there, and the regulatory framework isn't equipped to handle a situation where people are seeking a treatment that hasn't been proven but might work. You can't just tell people to wait 5 years for trial results when they're at risk of dying from an overdose next month.
Which is why the harm reduction perspective has gained traction even among people who are otherwise skeptical of psychedelic medicine. If people are going to do this anyway, we should at least understand what they're doing and try to make it safer.
That's where the observational research has value even without randomization. If you can document what's happening in these clinics, the protocols they're using, the outcomes they're seeing, the adverse events, you can start to develop evidence-based safety guidelines even before the controlled trials are complete.
What would you say to someone listening who's intrigued by the Ibogaine story, but, like Daniel, finds the hallucinogenic experience unappealing and is more interested in the pharmacological potential?
I'd say keep an eye on the analog development. That's where the action is for people who want the therapeutic benefit without the trip. Delix's DLX7 and other compounds in the pipeline are designed to do exactly that. They're not available yet, and they might not pan out, but if they do, they could represent a new class of addiction medication.
For the broader psychedelic medicine movement, Ibogaine is an interesting test case because it separates the trip from the therapeutic effect in a way that psilocybin and MDMA don't necessarily. With psilocybin for depression, the mystical experience seems to correlate with the therapeutic outcome. With Ibogaine, that correlation might not exist.
Which makes Ibogaine almost a philosophical challenge to the psychedelic medicine paradigm. If you can get the benefit without the experience, then the experience wasn't the mechanism, it was just a side effect. And that has implications for how we think about all of these compounds.
It also has regulatory implications. The FDA is much more comfortable with a drug that works through conventional pharmacological mechanisms than one that requires a mystical experience facilitated by a trained guide in a specially designed room. The former fits the existing approval framework. The latter requires inventing a whole new paradigm.
That's part of why the Ibogaine analog approach has attracted venture capital. It's a cleaner regulatory story. You develop a molecule, run standard clinical trials, get approval, sell it through pharmacies. No therapy component, no special clinics, no spiritual guidance, just a pill.
Which some people in the psychedelic community would argue is missing the point, that the experience is the medicine, and reducing it to a pill loses something essential.
That's a legitimate perspective, but it's not a scientific one. If the data show that the analog works without the experience, then the experience wasn't essential. The question is empirical, not philosophical.
Let's talk about the chemistry for a moment. Ibogaine is an indole alkaloid, same chemical family as psilocybin and DMT, but structurally, it's quite different. What makes it unique?
The ibogaine molecule has this unusual structure called an iboga cage, a rigid, three-dimensional arrangement of carbon and nitrogen atoms that's not found in many other natural products. That rigid structure is part of why it binds to so many different receptors. It's not a flexible molecule that can conform to different binding pockets. It's more like a key that happens to fit into a surprising number of locks.
That's what makes it a dirty drug.
The challenge for medicinal chemists is to modify that structure, to tweak the iboga cage in ways that preserve binding to the therapeutic targets while eliminating binding to the problematic ones. It's a molecular engineering problem of considerable complexity.
Which is why it's taken this long to get promising analogs. It's not a simple molecule to modify.
The iboga alkaloids are not easy to synthesize from scratch either. Most of the ibogaine used in research and in clinics comes from semi-synthesis, starting with a related natural compound extracted from the plant and then chemically modifying it. Total synthesis is possible but expensive and low-yielding.
If this ever becomes a widely prescribed medication, you've got a supply chain question. You can't just order 100 kilos of ibogaine from a chemical supplier the way you can with aspirin.
That's a solvable problem if the demand is there. Pharmaceutical companies figure out synthesis and scale-up for complex natural products all the time. But it's another reason why the analog approach is attractive. You can design the molecule to be easier to manufacture.
All right, I want to circle back to something Daniel said. He mentioned that the idea of using hallucinogens in pharmacotherapy is about the only context in which he finds the idea appealing, and I think that's actually the mainstream view. Most people are not interested in recreational psychedelics, but if their doctor said, "This medication could help with your condition," they'd consider it.
That's the audience that the pharmaceutical industry is ultimately aiming for. The psychedelic experience is a barrier to adoption for most people, not a selling point. If you can remove that barrier while preserving the therapeutic benefit, you expand the addressable market enormously.
Which creates an interesting tension with the grassroots psychedelic movement, which has been built around the transformative power of the experience itself.
There's definitely a cultural tension there, but from a public health perspective, the question is, what helps the most people? If ibogaine analogs can treat addiction effectively and safely, they should be developed regardless of whether they preserve the subjective experience. The goal is to save lives, not to preserve a particular cultural practice.
Addiction is a big enough problem that even a modestly effective new treatment would be enormously valuable. You mentioned 70,000 opioid deaths a year. That's more than the entire population of a mid-sized city.
It's not just deaths. For every fatal overdose, there are many more people whose lives are severely diminished by addiction. Lost jobs, broken families, criminal justice involvement, the whole cascade of consequences. The societal cost is in the hundreds of billions annually. A treatment that could meaningfully reduce that burden would be one of the most important public health developments in decades.
We're in this waiting period where the promise is tantalizing, the risks are real, the science is advancing, and the regulatory framework is slowly shifting. That's a lot of moving pieces.
That's what makes it such a fascinating topic. It's not a simple story of a miracle cure or a dangerous hoax. It's a complex scientific and policy question with real stakes. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact. The average cumulus cloud weighs approximately 1.1 million pounds, roughly the same as 200 adult elephants. And yet it floats because the weight is distributed across millions of tiny water droplets spread over an enormous volume of air.
For listeners who are interested in this topic, what should they actually do with this information? What are the practical takeaways?
First, if you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, do not go looking for Ibogaine on the black market or at an unregulated clinic abroad. The existing evidence-based treatments, methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone, and behavioral therapies are safer and better studied.
Second, if you're interested in the research, the Texas trial is worth following. It's publicly registered on clinicaltrials.gov, and the results, when they come, will be a major data point in this conversation.
Third, the Ibogaine analog space is exciting but still early stage. If you hear about a miracle cure or a breakthrough that sounds too good to be true, it probably is. The timeline is years, not months.
Fourth, this is an area where the policy conversation is moving quickly. The 2026 executive order is creating real momentum. If you have strong feelings about psychedelic medicine policy, your representatives are probably hearing about this right now, and your voice matters.
The broader lesson here is that addiction treatment is finally getting the kind of serious scientific attention it deserves. Ibogaine is just one thread in a much larger rethinking of how we approach this problem. And that's encouraging, even if the Ibogaine story itself is still being written.
There's a question that I keep coming back to. If the Ibogaine analog approach works, if we can develop a medication that resets the addicted brain without the trip and without the cardiac risk, what does that mean for how we think about addiction itself?
It would challenge the idea that addiction is primarily a psychological or spiritual condition that requires psychological or spiritual intervention. It would suggest that, at least for some people, addiction has a neurobiological substrate that can be addressed pharmacologically in a way that produces lasting change. That doesn't mean psychology and social support don't matter, they clearly do. But it might mean that for some patients, the biological intervention is the necessary precondition for everything else to work.
That would be a significant shift from where addiction medicine has been for the past few decades.
And it would open up questions about other conditions that involve compulsive behavior, obsessive compulsive disorder, certain eating disorders, maybe even some forms of depression. If you can pharmacologically promote neural remodeling in the circuits that drive compulsion, the applications could be broader than addiction alone.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. The first step is proving that it works for addiction in a controlled trial. Everything else is speculation.
And that's where we are. The Texas trial is recruiting, the analog companies are in preclinical or early clinical development, and the rest of us are watching and waiting.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing as always.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.